content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated April 14, 2025. Time is in white, large block capital lettering, superimposed upon a background that is multicolored. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a white, narrow inner border. The End Game by Simon Schuster is the caption on today's cover photo. It is of Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky in his presidential office, March 21. President Zelensky is not smiling. He is looking straight at the camera with dark, piercing eyes. He has short-cropped, dark hair, dark facial hair. He's wearing black. He's sitting on the edge of a black-topped desk. Behind him is a piece of rather ornate-looking wood furniture with gilt trim. On the walls are perhaps some types of insignia framed, and in between there are greenish draperies and a tan-colored wall covering. Beginning with How the Fighting Ends, under the heading World, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky speaks out on Trump, Putin, and the price of peace. This is by Simon Schuster, Kiev. In this photograph, which is a double-page spread, Zelensky is standing behind that dark-top desk, which now looks more dark green than black. There are books lying on top of the desk. There's a large telephone contraption to one side. It has many, many, many keys, like the old switchboard-type handheld reception desk phone. Lots of doorways in heavy wood with gilt trim, a flag in the background with blue and gold, and again this gigantic framed insignia motif, which contains dozens of insignias placed side by side in a geometrical fashion. Again, this is by Simon Schuster in Kiev. He is the only writer of this. Nearly 6 years have passed since Volodymyr Zelensky was elected president of Ukraine, yet he still cringes at all the polished brass and chandeliers that crowd his office. The place does seem rather gaudy, like a room plucked straight from Mar-a-Lago, and Zelensky cannot seem to stop apologizing for it as he shows me around one evening in March. He would rather scrap the furniture, he says, rip down the pilasters, use white paint to hide the gold leaf on the ceiling. But, you know, we have not had much time for renovations, especially these last few years, he says, referring to the war. Only in the back of his chambers, behind Ukraine's version of the Resolute desk, is there a space that feels like home to Zelensky. A small room with a single bed and a set of paintings he chose himself. They're not museum pieces. At the local bazaar, similar ones might fetch a few hundred dollars at most. But they matter to the president because of what they represent. The one that hangs above his bed shows a Russian warship sinking into the Black Sea. Another shows Ukrainian troops fighting recently on Russian territory. The third, Zelensky's favorite, shows the Kremlin engulfed in flames. Each one's about victory, he says, as we cram into the space for a look at the pictures. That's where I live. But he did not invite me over for a tour. His basic aim, as far as I could tell, was to clear the air after his recent visit to the Oval Office, the one that became a viral sensation for the world and a source of trepidation for his country. For several interminable minutes, the morning of February 28, President Donald Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance berated Zelensky, calling him ungrateful, weak, dangerous, while talking over his attempts to argue back. You don't hold the cards, Trump told Zelensky. You're gambling with World War III. On the advice of people he trusts, Zelensky has mostly avoided talking about the episode, not wanting to deepen a diplomatic crisis that had threatened to cost him nothing less than his country's existence. His standard answer to questions about it has been, let's leave that to history. Even now he hopes to turn the page and move on, but his instincts rarely allow him to keep quiet for long about the things that bother him, which is partly what got him into trouble with Trump. Going into that meeting, Zelensky says he had it all planned out. He had been to the White House a handful of times during the war, but this would be his first sit-down with Trump in the Oval Office, and it would mark a critical point in Trump's effort to force a peace deal in Ukraine. To make an impression, Zelensky decided to bring a set of gifts. Their aim was to break through any ill will the U.S. president felt toward Ukraine, and to dispel what Zelensky believed was the influence of Russian propaganda on the White House. One of the gifts fit with an emerging tradition of the Trump era, in which guests bring shiny tokens of their respect and fealty. In a recent example, Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, gave Trump a golden pager, commemorating the explosive devices Israel used to kill or injure thousands of its enemies last year in Lebanon. Vladimir Putin went further than that, commissioning an oil painting of Trump and sending it to the White House in March. In Zelensky's case, the gift was even glitzier, the championship belt of his friend Oleksandr Usyk, who holds the world heavyweight boxing title. As he took his seat in the Oval Office, Zelensky placed the belt on a side table near his right elbow, planning to reach over and hand it to Trump in front of the assembled journalists. Instead, as the televised briefing began, Zelensky reached for another of his gifts. It was a folder containing a series of gruesome photographs showing Ukrainian prisoners of war after their time in Russian captivity. Some of their bodies were grotesquely emaciated. Others showed signs of torture. That's tough stuff, Trump said, his face leaden, as he took the photos from Zelensky and began leafing through them. Those pictures, according to some U.S. officials, marked the point when the meeting went wrong. Had Zelensky offered the championship belt, the gesture might have lightened the mood. The photos have the opposite effect. They seem to get Trump's guard up, as though he were being blamed for the suffering of those soldiers. Still, even today, Zelensky does not regret his decision to present the images. He'd been trying to reach beyond Trump's transactional instincts, beyond his need for flattery, and appeal to Trump as a human being. He has family, loved ones, children. He has to feel the things every person feels, Zelensky says. What I wanted to show were my values, but then, well, the conversation went in another direction. One of the most painful exchanges in the Oval Office meeting took place near the end, when Zelensky asked whether Vance had visited Ukraine during the war. They both knew he had not, and Vance shot back that he had no interest in Zelensky's propaganda tours. The insult must have stung. Throughout the invasion, it's been the policy of Ukraine to encourage guests to see its destruction up close. Zelensky often takes visitors to hospitals full of wounded soldiers, ruins caused by missile strikes, mass graves left behind by Russian forces. Envoys from the White House have made a point of avoiding such excursions since Trump took office in January, but Zelensky remains committed to their value in diplomacy, and his team invited me to take such a trip the day of our interview. Late that morning, the presidential convoy drove out from Zelensky's office toward Kiev's western suburbs and came to a stop in the village of Moshchun. Before the Russian invasion, the place had a population of about 800 people, and its claim to fame was that Zelensky, in his early career as an actor and comedian, had filmed one of his most popular sitcoms here. Now, throughout Ukraine, Moshchun is known as the hamlet where the Russian attempt to seize Kiev failed. The battle that raged in the surrounding fields and forests for 23 days in late February and March of 2022 was arguably the most consequential to take place in Europe since the Second World War. Had it ended differently, the Russians might have succeeded in encircling Kiev, ousting Zelensky, swallowing up most of Ukraine, redrawing the European map. Instead, hundreds of Russian commandos were slaughtered at Moshchun by a ragged mix of Ukrainian troops, policemen, National Guardsmen, regular civilians, some of them armed with nothing more than hand grenades and hunting rifles. Our warriors in Moshchun were outnumbered 13-1, Zelensky told me. That is not propaganda, he insisted. That is a fact. 3 years passed since Russia lost that battle, and we had come to mark the anniversary. For the occasion, the office of the local governor prepared an elaborate ceremony with a military band and an honor guard standing at attention, the bayonets of their rifles glinting in the sun. The field of battle, where at least 125 Ukrainians died, was now festooned with flags, some of which read, "Ukraine or Death." As we waited for the ceremony to begin, I walked over to a wooden hut where a few women were selling wartime souvenirs, little gnomes adorned with camouflage and bullet casings. Sidling up to me, a member of Zelensky's staff recalled how this scene had looked in previous years on the first and second anniversaries of the battle. It looked more real, he whispered. Maybe Vance had a point. It can be hard to hold the line between solemnity and propaganda. As time passes, fresh wounds become old scars. Battlefields become memorials. The kitsch starts creeping in. The scenery around Zelensky looked undeniably choreographed as he walked past the honor guard and set a wreath upon its stand. The immediacy of the events faded, and that complicates the diplomatic challenge Zelensky faces at this stage in the war. The survival of his country depends on his ability to maintain the support and sympathy of foreign allies. But as the war morphs into a deadly routine, it becomes harder for him to hold their attention and to keep people like Trump on his side. At the edge of the ceremony, one of the presidential guards suppressed a yawn, which made me do the same. It had been difficult to sleep the night before. The latest swarm of Russian drones appeared in the sky soon after midnight. They were reported to be Shaheds, or Martyrs, a design Russia had acquired from Iran. On social media, Ukrainians like to announce their arrival by posting emojis of a motor scooter, because the weapons sound like flying Vespas revving as they dive out of the clouds. In my apartment near the presidential compound, the air raid sirens failed to sound, so I woke up from the booms of the anti-aircraft cannons stationed on the rooftops, the light from their muzzle flashes dancing on my bedroom wall. Zelensky was on a train at the time, returning from his latest trip to Europe. One of his stops that week had been in Finland, which has the unfortunate distinction of sharing an 830-mile border with Russia, the longest of any NATO member. In the center of Helsinki, Zelensky took a tour of a sprawling underground shelter meant to keep Finnish citizens safe and comfortable in case of a Russian bombing campaign. Although its population's only 5.6 million, the country had built a network of these shelters, big enough for nearly 5 million people. These kids, they were playing hockey down there, Zelensky noted in amazement. They've got gyms, shops, like little towns, a huge amount of space. He had signed an agreement with the Finnish government to build similar warrens in Ukraine. On his way home by train, the screen of his iPhone flashed up with an air raid alert, noting the approach of the Shaheds. According to the Ukrainian Air Force, 214 of them would strike in waves throughout the night, some loaded with vacuum bombs that could incinerate entire buildings. The main target was the city of Odessa on the Black Sea coast, where the drones hit an apartment block, a shopping mall, and other businesses. They also cut off power to three districts of the city. One of Zelensky's closest allies, Peter Pavel, the president of the Czech Republic, happened to be in Odessa that day, and his train departed only 20 minutes before the bombardment began. The experience left him shaken. Earlier that day, Trump and Putin had a phone call to discuss the American proposal for a ceasefire, and the Russian leader said he would consider at least some of its terms. Pavel had trouble grasping the duplicity. One has to be truly cynical when declaring the will to have peace negotiations or negotiations on a ceasefire and at the same time to launch a massive attack on civilian infrastructure, he said during his visit with Zelensky the next day. It is extremely difficult to deal with such a party. Among Zelensky's international allies, Pavel has long been among the most steadfast and effective. In the first year of the Russian invasion, the U.S. scoured the world for the kinds of artillery shells Ukraine needed to keep up the fight, and it came up short. Then Pavel, the leader of a country smaller than Idaho, found a way to source more than a million of these shells, which the Czechs quickly transferred to Ukraine. I first met him last summer in Switzerland during a peace summit Zelensky hosted for more than 80 countries from around the world. Held in the Alpine resort of Bürgenstock, the summit was meant to advance Zelensky's vision for ending the war. It was based on a plan he called the Peace Formula, composed of 10 principles he saw as essential to any lasting settlement with Russia. Some of its demands struck his allies as fanciful. Point 5 called for the full and unconditional withdrawal of Russian troops from all of Ukraine. Point 7 demanded justice for all Russian war criminals, including Putin and his top generals. No one expected Ukraine to achieve all these goals, certainly not anytime soon. Still, Zelensky and his team saw the formula as their North Star. Not a practical roadmap to peace, but an ideal toward which the world's diplomats should aspire in seeking to end the war. It lays out what we would see as the final resolution of this crisis and its consequences, says Zelensky's chief of staff, Andriy Yermak, who also serves as Ukraine's lead negotiator. We stand by that vision. Like most of Ukraine's foreign allies, President Pavel supported the peace formula, but he had a far more sober understanding of how the war would end. He'd served in the military for most of his career, reaching the rank of general and working in the NATO high command. On the sidelines of the summit in Switzerland, he told me the eventual peace in Ukraine would be ugly, angry, and difficult for Zelensky to accept. Achieving a return of full sovereignty and territorial integrity is not a goal for the short term, Pavel said. It will not happen in the foreseeable future. He urged me to think instead about historical battle lines and occupations that remain frozen for decades. The Soviet domination of East Germany, for instance, where the Berlin Wall stood for more than 28 years, or the heavily militarized border between North and South Korea, which remain officially at war despite the truce reached in 1953, or the Baltic countries in Eastern Europe, which the Soviet Union occupied in 1940. Using sanctions against Moscow and other forms of diplomatic pressure, the West tried to resist that occupation, but it still went on for over half a century. All these examples, Pavel told me, serve as precedents for where the war in Ukraine will likely end up. I don't see a chance, he said, that Ukraine would be able to turn the war into their fast success. Indeed, in the months since the summit in Switzerland, Zelensky's grand vision for peace has been cut down to size. He no longer mentions the peace formula in his speeches. In October, as the U.S. presidential elections drew near, Zelensky presented a less ambitious plan. It consisted of only 5 points. The first one called for Ukraine to receive an invitation to join the NATO alliance, while the last two took a new approach, appealing to U.S. financial interests rather than any shared values. Among the enticements Zelensky offered was access to trillions of dollars worth of minerals hidden beneath Ukrainian soil. Last fall, after discussing that idea with Zelensky in New York, Trump seized on it, and his administration soon proposed a deal for the U.S. to profit from Ukraine's mineral wealth as compensation for military support. Zelensky balked at the terms Trump suggested in his first draft of the deal. But after weeks of tense negotiations, the U.S. and Ukraine settled on a version that both sides could accept. Zelensky and Trump were meant to sign it after their meeting in the Oval Office. Their arguments scuppered those plans. The next day, Trump set the minerals deal aside and decided to get tough with Zelensky. His administration announced a suspension of aid to Ukraine, including supplies of critical intelligence, weapons, ammunition. Trump's special envoy to Ukraine, General Keith Kellogg, said the Ukrainians had brought it on themselves. Zelensky failed in the Oval Office to demonstrate a willingness to accept Trump's plan for peace, and the U.S. response was sort of like hitting a mule with a 2x4 across the nose, Kellogg said. Got their attention. More than that, it hobbled Ukraine's armed forces on the battlefield. Without access to data from U.S. satellites, they lost the ability to detect the approach of Russian bombers and cruise missiles. As a result, Ukraine had less time to warn civilians and military personnel about an approaching airstrike. The impact was most acute in the Russian region of Kursk, where Russians made swift advances. But Zelensky declined to pin the blame on the Trump administration. It is not connected, he told me. Don't get me wrong. The state of morale always depends on whether your partners are standing beside you. But I would not say that the freeze influenced the operation in Kursk. In the coming weeks, Zelensky will keep making the case to Trump and Vance, appealing not to their narrow political interests, but to their principles as statesmen and human beings. In one of their recent phone calls, he even suggested Vance should reconsider his decision not to visit Ukraine during the war. "We are still waiting for you," Zelensky said with a laugh. The vice president did not respond. A few days later, as we stood near the doorway of Zelensky's office, I wondered what happened to the championship belt. Did he have a chance to give it to Trump? Or did he bring it home after the meeting? "I don't know," Zelensky told me. "Maybe it's still sitting there." In the confusion that followed the argument, he left it on the side table next to the sofa. Later that day, once the Ukrainians had gone, a member of the White House staff found the belt and took it to Trump's private dining room, where it now sits, with other souvenirs, a memento of failed diplomacy. That lengthy article, the cover page article, was slightly abridged. Next, under the world heading, the Venezuelans deported to El Salvador. Photo and text by Philip Holsinger. The photo's in black and white, not quite 2 pages. It's of a lot of military personnel with a big military truck and the personnel all lined up in formation. The caption reads, "A Venezuelan detainee is hauled off a plane after arriving in El Salvador the night of March 15th. The story is one column long. On the night of March 15, 3 planes touched down in El Salvador from the U.S., carrying Venezuelans the Trump administration designated as gang members and deported without due process. I was there to document their arrival. The transfer from the plane to the buses that would carry the detainees to prison was rapid. Soldiers and police lined the route to the prison. As we entered the intake yard, the head of prisons was giving orders to an assembly of guards. Show them they are not in control. The intake began with slaps. One young man sobbed when a guard pushed him to the floor. He said, 'I'm not a gang member. I'm gay. I'm a barber.' Trustees descended on the men with electric shavers, stripping heads of hair. The guy who claimed to be a barber began to whimper, folding his hands in prayer. He was slapped. The man asked for his mother, then buried his face in his chained hands and cried as he was slapped again. After being shaved, the detainees were stripped naked. More of them began to whimper. They entered their cells, 80 men per cell. For these Venezuelans, it was not just a prison they arrived at. It was exile to another world, a place so cold and far from home. They might as well have been sent into space, nameless and forgotten." Turning the page to the brief, business. This is not quite a full page article. Climate, the companies innovating the climate fight, by Jared Lindzen. AI, mealworms, aerospace, carbon capture, they're all innovative approaches companies are taking to try to stop the effects of climate change. A new analysis of the world's top green tech companies demonstrates the diversity of organizations fighting climate change and the positive reactions they have received from investors and customers. The analysis by Time in partnership with data firm Statista considered the positive impact, financial strength, and innovation of more than 8,000 companies developing products, services, or technologies to reverse the impact of human activities on the planet. The 250 top companies hail from over 30 countries on 6 continents. American firms accounted for 11 of the top 20. Switzerland's Climeworks ranks second behind Vermont-based battery-powered aircraft maker Beta Technologies. Climeworks has deployed its carbon capture technology at unprecedented scale. Its new mammoth facility in Hellisheiði, Iceland, captures 36,000 tons annually at peak capacity. and sells carbon credits to 160 customers, including J.P. Morgan Chase, Microsoft, Stripe, Shopify, and Lego. To limit global warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade, we need both rapid emissions reductions and carbon removal, co-CEO Jan Wurzbacher told Time in 2024. Carbon removal went from a niche could-be topic when Climeworks was founded in 2009 to a globally recognized solution required to achieve net zero, added co-CEO Christoph Gebold. Other niche approaches are breaking through in a crowded space. Top 10 honoree InnovaFeed is trying to solve the world's biggest challenges with some of its smallest inhabitants. The French biotechnology company, which has raised over $450 million to date, breeds insects in an automated vertical farm to harvest protein for plant and animal feed, reducing the need for more resource-intensive feeds and toxic fertilizers. And, of course, AI has found a place in green tech. Raquel Wurtison, CEO of Toronto-based Wabi, ranked 9th, creates AI-driving systems with partners like Volvo Autonomous Solutions to automate the long-haul trucking industry, making it more efficient and sustainable along the way. The analysis illustrates the breadth of business leaders of the young green tech industry, sprung from a global effort to better sustain the planet. Time has listed the world's top green tech companies of 2025. There are 20 listed. I will read to you the ones with U.S. indicated as headquarters. Beta, U.S. Apeel, A-P-E-E-L, U.S. Meati, M-E-A-T-I, U.S. TAE Technologies, U.S. Impossible Foods, Fervo Energy, Ormat Technologies, ChargePoint, Geno, G-E-N-O, Enervenue, and 24M, all in the U.S. Next page, checking in. About a third of a page photo here, whose caption I shall read. A man calls his son from the street in front of his home as wildfires burn around him in Wisong, South Korea, March 24. Firefighters tackled at least 9 fires across the country that burned more than 36,300 acres and forced thousands of residents to evacuate. In Wisong, a fire destroyed a Buddhist temple from the 7th century, the Korea Heritage Service said. There's this man just standing on a concrete roadbed. He's got boots on up to his knees, dark pants, a jacket, like kind of like a rain jacket in a beige color. He's got a tan-colored phone held up to his face. He's wearing a white mask. In the background, though, is a wall of red. A wall of red. It is the fire. The Bulletin. This is by Chantel Lee. Some states consider bills that would punish abortion patients. Abortion rights advocates are closely monitoring what they call a growing and alarming trend. Lawmakers in at least 10 states have introduced bills that would allow authorities to bring homicide charges against people who obtain abortions. Bills have been introduced in Georgia, Idaho, Indiana, Iowa, Kentucky, Missouri, North Dakota, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Texas, according to the Center for Reproductive Rights. Most of the states considering these measures have banned abortion in nearly all circumstances or after 6 weeks of pregnancy. The bills refer to an embryo or fetus as an unborn child or preborn child. They assert an embryo or fetus can be a homicide victim, opening the door for authorities to charge and prosecute people who terminate pregnancies. Some also propose removing clauses from existing state laws that protected pregnant people from being prosecuted for seeking abortions. In Indiana, North Dakota, and Oklahoma, these bills have failed to advance. Mary Ziegler, professor at the University of California Davis School of Law, says the likelihood of the remaining bills passing is relatively low. Typically, anti-abortion laws penalize medical providers for offering abortion care. Targeting pregnant people has proved unpopular, but Ziegler says the bills are more likely to pass now than they were in previous years, and the fact that they keep coming back is significant. Abortion opponents have been emboldened since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. Even absent homicide bills, at least 210 pregnant people faced criminal charges for conduct associated with pregnancy in the year after Roe was overturned. A report by the advocacy nonprofit Pregnancy Justice found. The finding portended what we're seeing right now, says Lizzie Hinckley, the center's senior state legislative counsel. Whether it's this year or next year or a few years down the road, this is a very harrowing indication of what the end game is for anti-abortion legislators and anti-abortion activists. The brief news. Good question. What is the mental toll of spending months in space? By Jeffrey Kluger. Small photo here in the middle of the page. It's mostly red, white, and blue. The caption reads, Williams, Wilmore, and Nick Hague look at ease during their ISS stay. The U.S. flag in red, white, and blue is hanging behind these three astronauts who are dressed in khaki pants, a blue shirt, a red shirt, and either a dark blue or a black shirt. They're all smiling. The longest 8 days Butch Wilmore and Suni Williams ever spent lasted more than 9 months. On June 5, 2024, the two NASA astronauts boarded the maiden mission of Boeing's new Starliner spacecraft for what was supposed to be a short shakedown cruise to the International Space Station, ISS, before turning around and heading home after just over a week. But that was not to be. Mechanical problems aboard Starliner led NASA to conclude the spacecraft was not fit to carry the astronauts home. Instead, the ship left the station and splashed down uncrewed, leaving Wilmore and Williams to join the station rotation, living and working aboard the ISS until a fresh SpaceX Crew Dragon spacecraft arrived and they could come home. They splashed down March 18, a full 278 days after they were originally scheduled to depart the ISS. So what kind of emotional adjustment did Williams and Wilmore have to make as they went from overnight guests to long-term ISS residents? And what will the reacclimation to life on Earth be like after so much time away from home and family, and for that matter, gravity? Before Wilmore and Williams make the adjustment of returning to Earth, of course, they had to prepare themselves for leaving it in the first place. And that was a process they were at least partly denied. Training for a long-duration space mission is equal parts physical and mental. And it's the mental piece, saying goodbye to all earthly people and things for half a year or more that they missed out on, instead training for just an 8-day mission. That comes at a price. In 2015, Time visited Russia's Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan to film the documentary series A Year in Space about astronaut Scott Kelly's near 12-month stay aboard the ISS, just 2 days before Kelly launched from Baikonur. Time spoke to astronaut Jeffrey Williams, part of the backup crew, who would have flown in Kelly's place if he were unable for some reason to go. He confessed that if that day, 48 hours before liftoff, Kelly were suddenly scratched from the flight, it would be a challenge for him to get up to speed mentally, since there's simply no substitute for having fully and wholly prepared for the actual fact that he would be leaving Earth for a year. Still, to all appearances at least, Wilmore and Williams quickly fit into the ISS life cycle, at least if NASA live streams of the pair at work both inside the station and during spacewalks were any indication. SUNY has just oozed such joy for the past 8 months, says retired astronaut Marcia Ivins, a veteran of 5 space shuttle missions and a friend of both Wilmore and Williams. A large part of our training is to learn to deal with the unexpected, the off-nominal, the contingency scenarios. Coming home will present different challenges. The toughest thing about returning to Earth after many months in space is adapting to gravity, says retired astronaut Terry Virts, a veteran of 2 space flights, including 1 long-duration stay as ISS commander. The grueling rehab program NASA put me through was key to my quick adaptation back to my planet. The first few days were not fun, but I was religious about doing my daily workouts, and I was back to driving and normal daily life more quickly than I expected. The mental part is critical, too. It is important to get back to Earth mode from a psychological perspective, says Virts. For me, it was like a light switch. One day I was living in space, and as soon as I got back to Houston, I was just back to my normal life. It is really important to have goals and things to look forward to down here, as you may or may not get another chance to fly in space. It is way too early to say if Wilmore or Williams will fly again, or whether their extended stay aboard the ISS will be their last trip off Earth. If Wilmore and Williams indeed step away from space, they will do so, having distinguished themselves in, as Ivins puts it, the most off-nominal of missions. SUNY and Butch accepted the unexpected extension to their mission with such grace and humor, she says. It makes me even more proud to call them my friends. Milestones. Well, I'll start with the column of short items. We have died, elected, resigned, and announced. Announced. The news, March 13. That fashion house Versace's chief creative officer, Donatella Versace, would step down April 1 after nearly 3 decades of leading the brand, founded by her brother, Gianni. Resigned, Louis DeJoy, as Postmaster General of the U.S. Postal Service, March 24. The news came after he agreed to allow the Department of Government Efficiency inside the Postal Service to make cuts. Elected, the first female president of the International Olympic Committee, Kirsty Coventry of Zimbabwe. She's the 10th president of the committee since it was founded in 1894. Died, Jeffrey Bruce Klein, founder and editor of the progressive magazine Mother Jones, March 13. He was 77. Former U.S. Representative Mia Love of Utah, March 23 at 49. She was the first black Republican woman elected to Congress. Han Jong-hee, co-chief executive of Samsung Electronics, March 25. He was 63. Died, George Foreman. Thriller and Griller by Sean Gregory. There's a photo here of Foreman in a younger day in his boxing gear. George Foreman, heavyweight boxing champion who died March 21 at age 76, transformed himself from brooding American sports destroyer into beloved, avuncular everyman like no other athlete on the planet. A former teenage petty thief who turned to boxing for salvation, Foreman won a gold medal for the U.S. at the 1968 Olympics, and in 1973 he took the heavyweight champion away from Smokin' Joe Frazier on the strength of a right uppercut that was so ferocious, announcer Howard Cosell exclaimed three times, "For the ages, down goes Frazier!" Muhammad Ali took the belt back a year later at the Rumble in the Jungle in the Congo, then known as Zaire, by employing a rope-a-dope strategy in which Ali took punches that tired Foreman out before counterattacking. Foreman was so unpopular that crowds in Kinshasa chanted, "Ali Bumbaya," or "Ali kill him." By 1977, Foreman quit the fight to become a preacher. He returned to the ring a decade later for a singular second act. A plumper, more affable Foreman reclaimed his crown in 1994 at age 45 by knocking out Michael Moorer. He's likely to remain the oldest heavyweight champ of all time for generations, if not forever. The same year, Foreman lent his name to a kitchen appliance that cooked countless burgers and hot dogs. And in a memorable episode of The Office, the foot of boss Michael Scott, thanks to the George Foreman grill, the champ became far richer as an entrepreneur than he ever was as a fighter. The past three decades have seen Foreman's smiling face hawking everything from grills to mufflers to Medicare plans. He had a short-lived network sitcom and appeared on The Masked Singer. In the early 1990s, Foreman spoke to Time about his motivations for returning to the ring. "If an old man like me can come back from the dead," said Foreman, "then that's a victory for mankind." And the final column, convicted, Iran's hired guns, Brooklyn plot. This is by Carl Vick. After deliberating for less than 4 hours, a federal jury in New York City, March 20, returned guilty verdicts against two Eastern European gangsters hired by Iran to send a hitman to the Brooklyn home of an Iranian dissident. The intended victim, Masih Alinejad, is a journalist and activist with nearly 9 million Instagram followers and the personal enmity of Iran's supreme leader, who calls her the American agent. The trial of Rafat Omarov and Polad Omarov detailed the regime's assassination apparatus from the Google searches of an Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps brigadier to photos of the target's home forwarded on WhatsApp. Iran agreed to pay $500,000 in the July 2022 plot, its third effort to kill Alinejad. In November, the Justice Department revealed a fourth, indicting an ex-con Iran, also asked to arrange the assassination of Donald Trump. Review by Judy Berman. Streamers rush to the ER, but Pulse is DOA. When money gets tight, as it is in Hollywood now, industries default to dependable formulas, hence the many new shows set in emergency rooms, reuniting producers of or ER drama ER with one of its stars, Noah Wyle, Max's The Pit, whose debut season unfolds over a single shift, is the best and buzziest of the bunch. NBC sitcom St. Denis Medical gives emergency medicine the mockumentary treatment. Apple has a dry German language take in Berlin ER. Each of these series puts a novel spin on the format. The same cannot be said of Netflix's first English language medical procedural, Pulse. Set at a hectic Level 1 trauma center in Miami, the soapy drama opens as a hurricane rolls in. The staff is at a distinct disadvantage because its popular chief resident, Xander Phillips, Colin Woodell, has just been suspended pending a sexual misconduct investigation. The show's protagonist is his accuser, Danielle Danny Sims. Willa Fitzgerald, who's shocked when her boss, Dr. Natalie Cruz, Justina Machado, names her interim chief. As gossip circulates and flashbacks reveal the complexity of Danny and Xander's relationship, Cruz's daughter is brought in critically injured. Adding to the contrivances, Danny's sister Harper, Jesse Yates, is also an ER resident working through the storm. It might have been possible to extract a fun show from this setup, but the execution is even shoddier than the premise. Patients are a blur of slit-open chest cavities. An impressive supporting cast, including Machado and Nestor Carbonell, who plays a big-shot surgeon, is wasted in one-note roles. Foregrounded, instead, is a misguided Me Too plot in which Danny and Xander's story is milked for cheap suspense, as Danny's tritely troubled past is played for sympathy. Fitzgerald makes a decent lead, but it would take a remarkable performance to save this material. The only surprise in this predictable potboiler is its provenance, as a collaboration between first-time creator Zoe Robin and Lost co-showrunner Carlton Cuse. 20 years ago, Cuse was reinventing network TV. Now he's harvesting its stalest chestnuts for a risk-averse streaming era. Time Off Movies review A Traumatic Iraq War Mission unfolds in real time by Stephanie Zakarik. This will be abbreviated. You don't need to have fought in a war to make a great war movie, though neither Steven Spielberg, Francis Ford Coppola, nor Stanley Kubrick did. The movies they made about the horrors of combat endure. But you could argue the stakes are higher when a filmmaker who's been to hell and back sets out to express the truth of his experience, as, say, Sam Fuller did, using his old World War II diaries as the basis for his great, grim 1951 Korean War set film, The Steel Helmet. Members of the armed services who've seen combat and lived to tell about it often don't tell about it, which makes the accounts of those who do mean that much more. Iraq War veteran Ray Mendoza has teamed with Civil War and Ex Machina director Alex Garland to make Warfare, which the two wrote and directed together. Mendoza was part of a team of Navy SEALs who one day in November 2006 were sent into an apartment building in Ramadi Province, Iraq, on a treacherous surveillance mission. Within just a few hours, Al-Qaeda forces had tossed a grenade in their midst, injuring two SEALs, one of them sniper and medic Elliot Miller, played in the movie by Cosmo Jarvis. Miller was even more seriously wounded, along with another SEAL, Joseph Quinn, when an IED exploded outside the building as they were being evacuated. Warfare tells the harrowing story of their rescue in real time, even though much of this movie is constructed from long, languorous takes. The film moves forward in tense fits and starts. The squeamish will need to steel themselves for Warfare. Though the camera work is relatively discreet, the imagination all too easily fills in any gory details the eye cannot see. But if a movie can be elegant and brutal at once, this one is. The dissipating smoke from the grenade hangs in the air, a pinkish gold mist. Polka dots of sunlight stream through a scattering of bullet holes in a door. Mendoza and others who took part in the mission, played by a group of fine young actors, including DeFerro Wunatai, Charles Melton, and Will Poulter, pieced the story together from memories of that day. Miller does not remember the day's events at all, and Mendoza has said he wanted the movie to be a living snapshot for him, a way of honoring all that he lived through but cannot recall. Most war films strive to establish their characters as individuals. Warfare is different. Though we become intimately familiar with each young face, the men's names and specific jobs are blurrier. The idea is that if one of them goes down, the rest feel it acutely, all connected by a single circuit. As for those of us who know about the experience of those in the military only from movies and television, sometimes after a lifetime of viewing, the older you get, the younger these characters look. These are the people, men and women, we sent to war, and the U.S. doesn't have the greatest history of caring for them upon their return. That article was slightly abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.